Today, we look at controversial, never-ending jail sentences after an inquest into the death of yet another prisoner serving an IPP. And the £30 billion coronavirus budget. Let me start with a warning. You may find some of the details in this piece distressing. Imagine you do a really stupid thing, an illegal thing. You steal a car and you go to prison for that. And then imagine that there is no release date, that you don't know if you will ever get out. That's what happened to Tommy Nicol.
He sent me. This is like his...
This is a birthday card.
Yeah, it was a birthday card from him to me, and he wrote lots of love.
And then he signed it.
Biggest brother in the world.
Biggest brother in the world.
And then he drew a picture of our mum at the bottom.
And there's a little face, little doodle of a face with mum next to it.
This is Tommy's sister, Donna Mooney, showing The Guardian's Jamie Grierson old photographs and birthday cards that bring back fond memories.
Yeah. And you can tell from that picture how protective he is, you know.
Like, yeah, he's got his arms around his siblings, giving them all a big hug. How old was he there?
Maybe 11, 12.
Tommy had been in and out of prison since the age of 18, but it was only in his early 30s that he was placed on what is called an imprisonment for public protection, or IPP sentence, on which people are not told when or if they are ever going to get out. Donna says it was Tommy's feeling of hopelessness that led him to take his life in 2015. And the family of Charlotte Noakes blame IPPs for her death too. The inquest this month into what happened to her has placed this controversial sentence under scrutiny again, raising the question why, when IPPs were abolished in 2012, there are thousands of people still serving time on them. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the never-ending prison sentence. Jamie Grierson, The Guardian's Home Affairs correspondent. You went to visit Donna at her house, didn't you?
We went to see her at her home in Wimbledon. We sat on her sofa with a cup of tea, and she told me all about her childhood with her brother Tommy.
Tommy as a person was very loving. He was extremely protective of the people that he cared about. I remember being in school, talking to him at home and saying, you know, I was really sad and people were being mean to me. And I remember him saying to me, call me when it happens. And he came to the fence and was like talking to me through the fence. Sorry.
It's okay, you take your time. You don't have to talk about anything.
You know, like just talking to me through the fence, trying to make me feel better. And like he couldn't do anything, but by doing that just helped. We had a difficult childhood, to say the least. I don't really want to go into kind of details of it, but it was traumatic, yeah.
And did that, do you think the sort of trauma, as you say, it's traumatic experiences had a bearing on Tommy later in life?
Definitely, 100%. You know, I think knowing about how trauma affects children's brains and their development, definitely.
Tommy had a very troubled childhood.
Yeah, so Tommy ended up falling in with a much older crowd, and he was in and out of jail from his late teens. When he was 32, he was sentenced to an IPP, an imprisonment for public protection. And this is this controversial sentence, which many see as potentially being a never-ending term.
What had he done?
Tommy stole a car, and he was charged with robbery, which basically means that there was an element of violence involved. In this case, the owner of the car ran out, tried to stop him. There was a bit of a tussle and his elbow got hurt. So Tommy was sentenced to an IPP with a minimum term of 4 years.
A minimum term? What does that mean?
All IPP sentences come with a minimum term, sometimes called a tariff, but no maximum term. The minimum term comes up, and then in order to be released from jail, you have to complete a parole board assessment. Every 2 years, Tommy would have had the opportunity to go in front of the parole board for an assessment, and he failed that on more than one occasion.
did you get the impression he'd probably be out in 4 years?
Definitely, yeah. He stayed out of trouble, didn't take any drugs. He was an enhanced prisoner, so he got like the top job in the prison that you could get, working in kitchens with knives and stuff like that, you know.
At the time of his death, he'd been in prison for 6 years, but he'd just failed a parole board assessment and been told he wouldn't be eligible for another 2 years. So he was basically facing at least 8 years in prison at the time of his death.
Why did he keep failing these assessments?
He was desperately struggling to get onto therapy courses, which he was being told were basically essential for him to pass his parole board assessment and get out of prison.
So this is a form, it's titled Unit Application, G4S HMP Ryhill, and it's dated 10th of April 2010. And there's a section saying, please explain your application. And Tommy has written,
I would like to be put on the anger management, please, as it's part of my sentence plan.
And department response says,
we don't run anger management at HMP Ryhill. So what he often found was that he would be moved to a prison that doesn't offer any rehabilitation courses that he needs.
After Tommy's death, there was an inquest. And through that process, a wealth of information was released to Donna, which she still has in her possession. And these are predominantly reports filed in the prisons, including complaints, handwritten complaints that Tommy had sent to prison authorities. And I sat and went through each of these documents with Donna.
And he's written on the form, I was supposed to move from Ryhill to Warren Hill to start the course that I asked to do 4 years ago. I'm now in HMP Coldingley, over tariff and unable to comply with my sentence plan as there is no course here. I would like to take this to a judicial review.
And you can see in these complaints that he's writing that he's becoming more and more distraught as time passes by.
This has come to psychological torture of a person who's doing 99 years.
That's really sort of harrowing, isn't it, to read?
I almost feel like in that he's giving up a little bit, you know, like the fight has gone in him a little bit, even by his response, like, you're like, you're torturing me, I can't do any more than I'm doing.
And this is the thing with IPPs, and this has come up at several of the inquests into the deaths of IPP prisoners that I've investigated, that psychologists say that the sentence itself, the not knowing when or if you're going to be released, has massively detrimental effects on people, particularly those with pre-existing mental health conditions.
Clearly, it sounds like Tommy felt like he was in a labyrinth with no exit and being pointed in different directions every day.
The earlier complaints are quite matter of fact. He sort of says, I understand I have to be on this course to progress my sentence. What do I need to do? As time passes on and the notes pile up, the language becomes increasingly frantic. And then we also start to see the reports that were filed at the inquest of his behaviour in the last few months of his life.
And the night he was shouting out to all the prisoners that he's going to break out and save them all and he's the saviour. And
it sounds like delusional behaviour. And yet, well, you know for a fact that there was no mental health medical support.
No, nothing. And he spent 80 days in segregation on his own. He was on a hunger strike for 7 of those days.
80 days in segregation, that must have been equally as devastating on his mental health.
The worst place to put somebody who's having mental health issues is on their own in a room. He started cutting his face. He set fire to his cell, made a paper plate mask. He was chanting and talking to imaginary people, saying that he was a warrior, and he's clearly having a mental health episode. But because he's being a warrior, they're saying, oh, he's a danger, so we're going to move him, and we're going to move him to an unfurnished cell because he's not being compliant. It's the most extreme environment. It's a room with a mattress on the floor and a pot to go to the toilet, and that is it. There's no windows, there's nothing else in there. He was kept in there for over 24 hours.
Even then, there were no mental health interventions.
When they moved to unfurnished cells, they're fully searched on the floor, restrained and fully searched. And I saw this happening, like we watched this at the inquest. Not the search, but the moves. And it's, yeah, they're quite brutal.
It wasn't until, I think, the day or two before he died that finally a mental health nurse looked at him. But it was just too late. He attempted to kill himself and was found in his cell unresponsive.
He was unconscious and they put him in restraints to move him to hospital. It gets worse. And then he was in the hospital at 10:45 in the evening. They removed the restraints and he'd been sedated and he was unconscious.
and they reapplied them. Sorry. They reapplied the restraints again at 2:15 in the morning. And then he died on the 25th. And we didn't find out actually until... we were told that they switched his machines off that day, and we didn't find out until the evening because they said they couldn't find us. But they hadn't been asked to find us until they'd agreed that the machines were going to go off. So he died on his own.
This must have been really distressing for Donna, discovering this.
It was so awful for her to go through the inquest process. She's become almost like a campaigner on this issue. She's, you know, subjecting the Ministry of Justice to Freedom of Information requests, trying to assess the proportions of those who kill themselves who are on IPPs against the normal prison population and so on.
Is it higher?
It is marginally higher, yeah.
Why did the IPP regime come about in the first place?
It was introduced by the Labour government in 2005. They were designed for offences where a life sentence wasn't appropriate, but the judges deemed that there was an element of risk or danger. Manslaughter, perhaps, and serious violent offences such as grievous bodily harm. But ultimately, that isn't how they were used. The Home Office at the time expected only about 800 people to be imprisoned under the IPP regime. But at its peak, there were more than 8,000 prisoners. So you can see that it was used far more widely than intended. And crucially, it was used for relatively low-level crimes.
And the reason we're talking about this now is because you've just attended the inquest of another IPP prisoner called Charlotte Noakes. What can you tell me about her case?
Charlotte had been sentenced for attempted robbery and possession of a bladed weapon. She was given a minimum term of 15 months, but 8 years later, she died in prison. The case has really stuck with me, partly because of the length of time Charlotte was in prison beyond her minimum term. I went to her inquest and I spent quite a lot of time with her dad, Stephen, and he was adamant that the IPP had contributed to her death in prison.
She was out begging. And she followed this lady, and she was quite, I wouldn't say aggressive, but she was sort of like following her quite a way. The police arrived and she was arrested, and she did have a knife on her.
The judge thought that an IPP sentence was appropriate.
What did Stephen tell you about his daughter?
The thing he was most passionate about when it came to Charlotte was her talent for art.
She would paint on almost anything. I've seen dustbins painted on.
And even while she was in prison, she had been offered a scholarship at the prestigious art school, Central St. Martin's.
With this offer open to her, I think she thought that she could actually make a career, she could actually become maybe quite famous at it.
And he also talked about some of the difficulties she encountered when she came out as gay.
She used to get beaten up and things like that because she was different.
And it was sort of later in her teenage years where she started to have some difficulties, both with the issues that arose out of her coming out as gay and also the breakup of his own marriage.
How did her behaviour start to change?
She started to use drugs and drink excessively.
And then gradually it got into stronger stuff. That's the time that she started to get in trouble with the police and things like that. She'd been to court, I think it was about 26 times.
Did the family understand when she was being sentenced what the IPP meant?
You know, they recalled being in the court, hearing a minimum term of 15 months and thinking, this is okay, Charlotte will be able to get through that.
And I just didn't understand what the imprisonment was all about. I thought it might be quite good for her to be there. It gets her away from drugs. And it was later on I started to realise that she wasn't as safe in prison as maybe I thought.
Steve said that when she went into prison, she had a mild level personality disorder. But by the end of her life, it was a high level personality disorder. And they watched that deteriorate during her time in prison. It was the sentence that was distressing her.
A lot of times we talk about the sentence and how it upset her and everything like that. She said, Dad, you really don't realise what this sentence is about, do you? You know, you don't realise this is a life sentence. And yeah, I'm going to die in here.
She was also being seen by a psychiatrist who was medicating her for her condition.
Diazepam she had, antipsychotic drugs, and on top of all the other drugs she was being given, she was actually not able to function sometimes. They would find her falling into her food.
This featured in the inquest that the treatment that she was being provided kind of hindered her progress because she was walking around in this zombie state, if you like.
You said that she'd been given a minimum tariff of 15 months, but died after more than 8 years in prison. What happened? Why?
Well, just like Tommy, she kept trying to get on courses and kept being told they weren't available. She'd been increasingly distressed in the weeks leading up to her death. She had attempted to take her own life. She went into her cell the day before she died, and it was the next morning during routine checks, she was found crumpled on the floor and was unresponsive, and she was pronounced dead at the scene.
How old was she?
She was 38.
How did Steve find out his daughter had died?
He was in Portsmouth, which is where he lives. He was in a shopping centre and he had a phone call from his other daughter, his eldest daughter.
And she said, I don't know how to say this, Dad. The police have been in touch with me and they said Lottie's died. Well, of course, I didn't believe it to start with. And then your legs go and everything like that. I think I was pretty numb for about 2 weeks.
He also said he just had to go and see her to believe it. He had to go and see her body to really believe that he'd lost his daughter.
And we went to her prison cell. I didn't realise how small they were, but most of the walls were covered with her artwork. Now, my understanding, they don't normally allow you to do that. So they'd let her do it, you know. Not in just her room. She'd done it in other prisoners' rooms as well, sort of thing, you know. It was, a bit surreal because you knew and that was the last place on earth she'd been.
Steve and the rest of Charlotte's family were clearly desperate to understand why their loved one, at the young age of 38, had died in prison. But they had to wait more than 3 years to get more information. They were convinced that the IPP had contributed to her death. What did the inquest conclude?
A pathologist gave evidence to the inquest. He told the jurors that he was unable to draw a definitive conclusion as to how she died. He suggested a probable cause could be something called sudden death syndrome, which would count as natural causes. So the inquest was left with two options: an open verdict, i.e. we don't know exactly how she died, or natural causes. And the jury ultimately went with natural causes. Steve spoke to Charlotte regularly on the phone, and most of the times he spoke to her, she would raise the issue of the IPP. So they wanted the inquest to raise the profile of the plight of not just Charlotte, but of other IPP prisoners who are in exactly the same position as she was.
Jamie, you've set out two incredibly sad cases, but it seems to me these are not just individual stories. What you're describing is a pattern of hopelessness and frustration when people are trapped in these never-ending sentences and trapped in a system that makes them unable practically to access the right courses to get released. I mean, it's almost Kafkaesque. And these IPPs were banned in 2012 because European judges said they breached human rights. Now, those two stories have a tragic ending, but you said thousands of others are still on them.
Yeah, that's right. There's more than 2,000 IPP prisoners. We can reasonably expect a significant chunk of those were sentenced for relatively low-level offences.
Hello.
Hello.
Alison.
No, I'm my daughter.
Oh, hi, you're right.
You have to excuse all the kids running around. No, we have three running around at the moment.
We spoke to a woman called Alison Miles, and she's the mother of Lawrence Owen. He was given a 2-year minimum tariff, and he's still in prison right now, and he's been in prison for 10 years.
He's 27. He had quite a tough childhood.
Lawrence and Alison both suffered domestic abuse, and so he was placed into foster care. When he got out, he got his own place to live, but he was struggling.
Set fire to his flat while he was in it, realised what he'd done was wrong, climbed out the window, got arrested, ended up in prison.
And obviously in the case of Lawrence, it sounds like there was a lot of sort of personal trauma surrounding what happened rather than sort of danger.
Yeah, and I think he should have been punished, but I still to this day believe he should have been put into a psychiatric hospital for treatment.
Alison goes to visit Lawrence every few weeks with some of his brothers and sisters. And when she takes the kids, it's the same story every time. They come away, these young, young kids, they want their brother to come home, and she leads them away from the prison in tears.
How does he feel that he's still on an IPP?
And what Alison says, he goes up and down. Sometimes he has optimistic moments where he thinks maybe the next parole board assessment will be my lucky day and I'll be released. But then other times she speaks to him and he's despondent.
They abolished the sentence in 2012. Do you recall that moment when they abolished the sentence and thinking, what does this mean for Lawrence?
I do, and I remember writing to the parole board and saying, well, now you've got to release him. It's against their human rights. You have openly admitted we've abolished it because it's against their human rights. To get told, well, no, it don't quite work like that.
Are there any plans to re-examine these cases and re-sentence them?
There are currently no plans to retrospectively change the sentences of those current prisoners serving IPPs. And that's really upsetting for the families. And what they're calling for really is to have their loved ones brought back before the courts and given a determinate sentence, meaning that they'll be given a date when they know they will be released ultimately. The crimes that some of these people were sentenced to IPPs for, they are being committed by other people now, and those people are being handed determinate sentences. So it's a situation where there's one rule for one batch of prisoners and one rule for another.
When IPP prisoners do get released, what happens then?
This is another interesting point with the IPPs, is that they have a never-ending license. You have to report to the probation service until at least 10 years after you've been released from prison, but potentially they can keep you on that license until you die. Obviously, there are some offences where there may be calls for this sort of sentence to apply, extreme cases such as terrorism or perhaps sexual offences. But that's not the case with the families we've spoken to. And I've heard story after story after story of these individuals where the IPP sentence was misapplied, they're languishing in jail, while others who are committing the same offences they did are going into prison and leaving again while they continue to be incarcerated.
Jamie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Grierson, our Home Affairs correspondent, who has written some really powerful pieces about IPPs. Do go to theguardian.com to have a read. He went to the Ministry of Justice about this reporting, and a spokesperson said, "A joint prison service and parole board action plan has been put in place to help prisoners serving public protection sentences to progress towards release." A huge thanks to Donna Mooney, Stephen Noakes and Alison Miles for speaking to us. If you need support with any of the issues raised in this episode, you can call Samaritans on 116 123. Coming up, a massive stimulus to the economy as the country faces a coronavirus crisis. Now, Rishi Sunak has delivered his first budget as Chancellor, and it felt extraordinarily different to the type of Conservative budgets we've been used to, with a £30 billion fiscal stimulus, including welfare and business support to help the country cope with a coronavirus epidemic. The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, explains.
Relatively few budgets live in the memory, but this one just might.
This is a budget delivered in challenging times. We will rise to this moment. We will get through this together. This budget.
The government has provided £12 billion next year to cope with the coronavirus. And that's split into two parts. Around £5 billion worth of that is extra public spending, mostly on the NHS, which the Chancellor said will be given whatever it takes to deal with the crisis.
Whatever it needs, whatever it costs, we stand behind our NHS.
And another £7 billion worth of measures which are supposed to help consumers, workers, businesses get through what the government expects to be a very difficult period for the economy over the coming months. So there are things such as sick pay is being extended to workers who are at the moment not covered by it, a more generous benefits system for people who can't work, and there's some business rate relief for businesses and some credit easing measures to make it easier for businesses that are having trouble with their cash flows. It is commensurate with the scale of the problems that currently exist, and more is promised if the economy does even worse than expected over the coming months. I think it probably measures up pretty well to what other countries have done. Most of the big Western countries have yet to come up with fiscal packages. Italy has done, but that's because it's got a much more serious outbreak. Other countries, I think, have yet to actually announce what they're going to do. So Britain's one of the first countries to move, and it is quite a bold package. In addition to the £12 billion for the coronavirus, there's another £18 billion to meet the promises the government made to level up the economy during the general election campaigns. There's extra money there for education, further education, for the NHS, for a whole range of infrastructure projects, broadband, roads, railways. And the feeling here is that the government needs to get a move on in actually getting these infrastructure projects going, because if you start an infrastructure project this year, it's going to be 3 or 4 years before the public sees any real sign of the progress that's being made. Well, it's certainly a budget for drinkers. Spirits duties have been frozen, beer duties have been frozen, wine duty and cider duty has been frozen. It's not a particularly good budget if you're on welfare. The people who it's really aimed at are the sort of people who are struggling to get by, the so-called working poor. And it's not an especially green budget either. I mean, the big road building investment schemes and the decision not to go ahead with the fuel duty increase have actually made it not an especially green package, despite one or two green measures tacked on to make it look a bit more green than it actually is.
For a period, it's going to be tough, but I'm confident that our economic performance will recover. Taken together,
this was a real giveaway package. I mean, a £30 billion package is the biggest, once inflation's taken into account, since 1992, when the then Conservative government was gearing up for an election that year. So you can't really say that this is not a big, bold attempt to actually change the way in which the British economy operates. And that, in a sense, this is a sort of tribute to the way in which Labour changed the shape of British politics after the election of Jeremy Corbyn as leader, because Labour spent the next 4 or 5 years attacking austerity and saying that governments needed to spend more and invest more and borrow more in order to raise the growth rate and deal with some of the underlying problems of the economy. And this budget represents Boris Johnson stealing Labour's clothes. It's all about trying to stimulate the economy through higher public borrowing and higher public spending, which in the past has definitely been Labour Party rather than Conservative Party territory. So in a way, it's good news for Labour in that its clothes have been stolen. In another way, it's quite bad because it's quite hard for them to attack it on the grounds that the Tories are now doing exactly what Labour said that they should be doing.
That's all for today. My thanks to Jamie Grierson and Larry Elliott. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.